Two of a Kind, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Donald Trump says America first. Narendra Modi pushes for Make in India. Are these two leaders cut from the same cloth?
They're not exactly alpha male, but they're very striking in the way they present themselves. They're both seen as being business friendly, but beyond that, there's a world of difference between them.
Plus, ISIS fighters prepare to defend the Iraqi city of Mosul to the last man.
They're choosing to die. A lot of them seem like they knew that this was going to be where the end was for them.
And a woman flying from Newark to Tel Aviv on an Israeli airline is asked to change seats just because she's a woman.
She felt kind of humiliated and degraded. Why should somebody ask me to move just because I'm a woman?
Those stories coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Mosul has a special place in the history of the U.S. war in Iraq. It was the site of fierce battles to secure the city in the country's far north, and dozens of American troops died there. That's one reason the capture of the city by ISIS 3 years ago was such a shocking turnabout. But now, after more than 8 months of bitter fighting, an Iraqi general says the fight to retake Mosul is almost over. Military officials say only a few hundred ISIS fighters remain and that they've been given a choice: surrender or die. Mosul is the last major city in Iraq with an ISIS presence. Stephen Kaling of Reuters News Agency is in northern Iraq on his way back to Mosul. He says the sense of anticipation in Iraq is building.
There's a lot of excitement on Iraqi state television, for example, looking forward to celebrating this. But it's good to be a bit cautious because there have been a lot of promises and expectations over the past year about when this was going to happen. And it often takes a little bit longer than most people hope and expect.
Can you give us a sense of what it's like there now?
This whole battle, I mean, for 8 months has been very complex urban warfare, street by street, house by house. What's different about the old city is that if you've been to an Arab city like Cairo or Damascus, it's very similar in that old, centuries-old, historic part of the city, which is crowded marketplaces, houses built on top of each other, not really clearly planned or organized. And so that's the environment that they're fighting in now. And this is the most difficult, demanding environment that you could really ask for in an urban environment. You can't drive a Humvee down the street. You have to get out of your vehicle and, you know, fight the enemy on foot. So that's really complex. There's also, as of a few weeks ago, it's hard to tell exactly the numbers, but there were at least 100,000 civilians in a pretty small neighborhood. So a lot of people are trapped there. Civilians have been a problem throughout this battle, an obstacle for the Iraqi forces. So really, this is just an intensified microcosm of the entire battle.
It sounds like ISIS is not completely spent either. I mean, I understand there was a significant ISIS counterattack yesterday. What happened?
That's right. There were a couple of suicide bombers that seemed to have infiltrated or crossed through the security barrier, the front line that the Iraqi forces had established, into areas that were considered previously cleared a few days earlier. And so they detonated their charges. It's a setback. And I think today the Iraqi forces spent their time. They imposed a curfew and they were going house to house. They were telling us they wouldn't even let us really get very close because they wanted to lock down the whole area. And go house to house to make sure that there are no more sleeper cells, hiding out in these areas, because that's something that could really delay their advance. That's one of those things that when we started saying, be cautious about a timeline, well, something like that could really set this back a couple of days, even a few weeks.
I understand the ISIS fighters remaining there have been told to surrender or die. What do they seem to be choosing?
They're choosing to die, which is kind of what we've been seeing the whole time. You know, if they have the chance to flee, some of them take that path, but a lot of them seem like they made their peace with this a long time ago, and they knew that this was going to be where the end was for them. Until, you know, a few months ago, there was a possible path out of Mosul, but that's pretty much been shut out. And unless you're going to try to blend in with civilians and risk getting caught in the screening process, there's really not much option for you. We also understand that there's a lot of foreign fighters in this area, and obviously they're not going to be able to blend in with the local population. So I think a lot of the fighters are, you know, really fighting to their last breath. And that's causing, unfortunately, a lot of destruction and a lot of death.
When this battle for Mosul started last October, many observers were worried the Iraqi forces, who are mostly Shiite, would actually alienate Mosul's Sunni Muslim population. How has the battle for the hearts and minds been going?
I think it's gone better than expected. There definitely was that fear. I think one of the things that's allayed that is that the regular military forces, they're the ones that have been really leading this fight. And some of the groups that were provoking more anxiety, some of these militias, some of them backed by Iran, those are really the ones that were provoking most of the anxiety. And for the large part, they've been kept out of the city. They've participated in the battle and they've contributed. But it's been more in a support role and sort of outside of the main population centers. There have been reports of abuses. Human Rights Watch has documented abuses by the government forces. But I think it's been a lot better than most people were expecting.
Stephen Kalin of Reuters. He's in northern Iraq. Thanks, and be careful out there.
All right. Thank you very much.
On May 30th, a few days after Ramadan began, ISIS took credit for two bomb blasts in Baghdad that killed 27 people. One of them was at a popular ice cream parlor in the predominantly Shia commercial area of Karada, where a crowd of young people and families had broken their fasts. Hassan Haddad lives in Baghdad and spoke with us soon after the attack. We're checking in with him again today. Hassan, remind us what happened to this ice cream shop that day.
So this was a couple of days into the holy month of Ramadan. A few hours after the breaking of fast, there was a bombing that targeted an ice cream parlor and restaurant in the Karada district of Baghdad. There were something like 12 killed and over 20 injured. And in the news, one of them was a 12-year-old girl that had gone to visit her grandfather from Australia, and she was one of the ones martyred.
Were you at the ice cream parlor that day?
I was actually at the restaurant adjacent to it. My friends and I had gone to break fast at the restaurant, and we ended up leaving about two and a half hours before the bombing took place. So it was a very close call.
When did the ice cream parlor reopen?
5 days. It was unbelievable. Most of the shop damage was the front facade, which was glass. So repairing and replacing was relatively simple. But the resilience of not only the shop owners, but the people in the neighborhood, in the community, the resilience that they showed was unbelievable. And when it did reopen, they gave out ice cream for free that night as a way to thank their patrons, their customers, and their neighbors.
What's it like there now, nearly a month later?
It's completely back to normal. I mean, traffic is heavy around that area, as always. And as far as the patrons to the ice cream shop go, it's back to business.
Has there been any increased security in the neighborhood since the attack?
There has. You do see an increase in traffic, police and some soldiers as well that patrol the area, especially that road.
I'm curious whether that bombing or those two bombings changed the atmosphere in Baghdad for the rest of Ramadan. Were people more cautious?
Absolutely not. The remainder of the month, people were going out and breaking fast in restaurants, and they continued to go to the ice cream parlor. On Twitter, some high-level officials were going to the ice cream parlor and snapping photos. The Turkish ambassador to Baghdad was one of them. The former Iraqi ambassador to the United States was another. You know, it was showing that the level of resilience is there, and that, you know, no matter how many times or regardless where they strike, the bad guys can't win. So it was good to see. As far as other neighborhoods and other restaurants, always packed. You have to reserve to get a table to break fast at these restaurants. So it was very good to see.
Have you been back to the ice cream parlor since?
Absolutely. Why wouldn't I go?
And you have two young children you probably bring too.
Absolutely, I do. Definitely. I mean, it's one of the few things that you can do to mix things up, to give them a treat. So definitely going out for ice cream is just a normal thing that people do here.
That's Hassan Haddad, a resident of Baghdad, speaking to us nearly a month after two deadly car bombs went off in the city. Thanks, Hassan.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you, Carol.
7 days. That's how much time Qatar has left to respond to an ultimatum by some of its neighbors. Last week, Saudi Arabia and its allies handed the tiny Persian Gulf nation a list of demands it needs to meet before they lift a trade and travel blockade. On that list of demands, shut down the state-funded news service Al Jazeera, which some of Qatar's neighbors have accused of giving a voice to terrorist organizations. Noha Miller is a professor of media at the University of Bedfordshire in the UK. I asked her why these countries have it out for Al Jazeera.
It is not about a Jazeera per se, but it's about Qatar foreign policy. And Qatar seems to have used its media outlets, including Al Jazeera, to have a louder voice in comparison to its tiny size. So now the accusation involving Al Jazeera is that it gave airtime to Jabhat al-Nusra, which branched out of Al-Qaeda. It gave airtime to certain groups. It took the side of certain dissenting or opposition forces like the Brotherhood, Muslim Brotherhood. And add to that that Al Jazeera hosting dissident voices from neighboring countries, including Bahrain and Kuwait.
Now, we have a spokesman for Al Jazeera, Jamal Al-Shayal, a little comment from him responding to the accusations that Al Jazeera is a voice for terrorist organizations. Here he is.
For the vast majority of the Arab people and our viewers around the world, Al Jazeera represents that idea that everybody should have a right to knowledge, everybody should have a right to information, everybody should have a right to hear what's going on and see what's going on, not only in their countries, but around the world.
Now, one thing I want to ask, based on what he just said, is that there seems to be a huge difference between Al Jazeera English and the regular Al Jazeera. And is the concern or charge that Al Jazeera is playing into demands of terrorists, is that around the Arabic language channel?
Yes, there is a huge difference between Al Jazeera English versus Al Jazeera Arabic. Al Jazeera English is widely considered a reliable source of news and more neutral and objective compared to the Arabic channels, which is far from it. And let's not forget that the Arabic channel faced mass resignations between 2009 and 2011 and 12, because many presenters and producers were unhappy with the way Qatar insisted that Al Jazeera's coverage remain aligned with the government's official stance on key regional conflicts.
Now, what if Qatar says, no, we're keeping Al Jazeera open?
I think it depends on the negotiations. It could be that Al Jazeera Arabic is shut down, but the English side survives. It could be that Al Jazeera network survives, both Arabic and English channels. But the real question here is, what would Al Jazeera Arabic look like, even if it survives? It will have to tone down its coverage of all neighboring countries, and so it will lose more of its credibility. So in any case, the blockade and shutting down Al Jazeera offices in many neighboring countries will strip Al Jazeera of its competitive edge because it wouldn't be able to cover the region where it is based.
Noha, I just want to ask you a long view question. You study media in the Arab world, media and journalism. Do you think whatever happens to Al Jazeera, that it was a good thing that it happened, you know, back in 1996? I mean, is the long-term impact of Al Jazeera a positive one for journalism in the Arab world?
Yes. I mean, yes, when it was set up in 96, I'm sure they didn't imagine the success they will heap later, but it made a big difference. And at that time, people were talking about the so-called CNN effect because many Arab audiences were simply going to CNN and, of course, the BBC to find out about what's happening. Especially after the 1991 Gulf War, when news about the war was absent from Arab channels. So Al Jazeera came in the right timing to basically fill the gap and say it's not only about the CNN and BBC Arabic, we're here as well. So they have made a huge difference on the Arab media scene.
Noha Meller is a professor of media at the University of Bedfordshire in the UK. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Welcome. Pleasure.
Coming up, Venezuela's AIDS program is in tatters, and a small country pushes to be called what it wants to be called. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Once upon a time, Venezuela's program for treating AIDS was an international model. But today, the country is in a deep economic crisis. Inflation is rampant. There are chronic shortages of basic supplies and medicine. And together, those have nearly destroyed the program. Stephanie Nolan covers Venezuela for the Globe and Mail in Toronto. She says when it began, Venezuela's AIDS program had a head start on much of the rest of the world.
The first thing is that it was early. Venezuelan people living with HIV took their government to the Supreme Court way back in 1998 and won the right to HIV treatment, to antiretroviral treatment, when it was new. And so Venezuela did it much sooner than a lot of other countries. And then under the socialist government of Hugo Chavez, there was also a really big commitment to expanding public health, which in the early years of that government was quite successful. And that included not only making the drugs widely available for free, but also making sure that high-risk groups such as men who had sex with men and sex workers had constant, reliable access to free condoms, and really rolling out HIV testing nationwide. And so that was a program that was a model for developing countries all over the world in the early 2000s.
Now, you covered the height of the AIDS epidemic in African countries more than a decade ago. What parallels are you now seeing in Venezuela?
I have to tell you, when I walked into the first hospital that I visited in Venezuela on my most recent trip, it felt like time travel. It felt like going back to Zimbabwe or Lesotho 15 years ago. I hadn't seen anything like that since then. Venezuela's hospitals are, they're frankly the worst public hospitals I've seen in the 85 countries I've reported from. They're worse than the hospitals in Mogadishu in Somalia at the height of the civil war. And you don't really see untreated AIDS very many places in the world anymore, but it's quite recognizable if you know what it is. And I recognized it immediately.
Stephanie, in what ways has the AIDS program in Venezuela been gutted?
To be honest, Carol, there's absolutely nothing left of it. There is no HIV treatment. There are no condoms available publicly. Condoms are selling for about 7,000 bolivars for a pack of three, and that's out of the range of virtually everyone to purchase. There's no testing for pregnant women anymore, which means that pregnant women are infecting their babies at birth, something that didn't used to happen in Venezuela. There is no infant formula so that women with HIV who can't breastfeed their babies have a way to feed their babies. There's just nothing left except the doctor. Except these incredibly committed doctors who for years have fought to protect this program as everything fell apart around them.
So what happens now when a patient goes to a hospital in Venezuela with HIV or any other illness?
Nothing. Nothing happens. And I actually had a doctor say to me, I just don't know why people come. Although I asked patients and they said they're coming for the compassion. They are not going to get treated. One of the patients I interviewed in the main hospital in Caracas died a couple of days after I met him for lack of a basic saline solution to hydrate him. I mean, not only are there no antiretrovirals, but there are no basic medications. And you get compassion. You get compassion and consolation from these doctors who have nothing else to offer you. You have no way to protect yourself from infection anymore. You have no way to confirm whether or not you are infected. And if you do develop AIDS, you have no access to drugs.
What are international AIDS organizations doing to help?
Nothing. The Global Fund to Fight HIV, TB, and Malaria, the main multilateral agency that would help here, has said it can't because its mandate is to help low-income countries. And Venezuela, which of course has the world's largest oil reserves, is not considered a low-income country. Activists from Venezuela and outside have been pushing the Global Fund to rethink that decision. The regional sort of arm of the World Health Organization has been allowing Venezuela to buy drugs through its strategic health fund. But in order to buy those drugs, the Venezuelan government has to use hard currency. And of course, it has a crucial hard currency crisis. And so that money is being allotted to HIV drugs only sort of sporadically.
Are antiretrovirals available through Venezuela's black market?
Yeah, but they are wildly expensive. They're being smuggled in like anything else on the black market. And a course of basic antiretrovirals will run you about $300 US a month. And on the black market, I mean, I don't even know what that is today, but it's probably somewhere in the order of 2.8 million bolivars in a month. And to give you an idea, minimum wage is 70,000 for a month. So that is out of the price range of virtually everybody. I should say that what I'm telling you about HIV is also true of everything else. If you go to the hospital today with kidney failure or cancer or anything else, they're also not going to be able to treat you. I think what was particularly stunning for me about the state of the HIV program is just that this is a place where Venezuela was such a leader and where for so long they managed to keep that program alive. And now even that is decimated.
You mentioned, you know, you talked to a few patients in there. What's the mood when you go into a hospital room and somebody's struggling from AIDS? What's it like?
It took me back to being in South Africa or Zimbabwe 15 years ago because people do know that treatment for HIV exists. They know they don't have to be dying from what they're dying of. And they also know it's entirely out of their reach. It's not going to come and it's not going to help them. And their death is inevitable at that point. And there is just a there's the pain of that realization, and then just also the fact that AIDS is a profoundly unpleasant way to die. People are just in extreme discomfort and distress, and it's very, very hard to see.
Stephanie Nolan is the Latin America correspondent for the Globe and Mail. Thanks, Stephanie.
Thanks.
For all its troubles, Venezuela has not yet completely disintegrated. One country that famously did fall apart about a quarter century ago, though, was Yugoslavia. That breakup spawned brutal wars and conflicts that went on for years. Most were eventually resolved, but one lingers, what to call one of the fragments. This small landlocked country calls itself the Republic of Macedonia. But here's the thing. Its neighbor Greece doesn't like the name, because there's also a Greek province called Macedonia. So Greece has insisted that the Republic of Macedonia call itself something else, the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. Yep, awkward. But after 26 years, the country's new foreign minister, Nikola Dimitrov, wants to change Greek minds.
My first bilateral visit was to Greece, and I have pleaded with our Greek friends and the Greek citizens, not only the politicians, and I have asked them to rethink what kind of a neighbor they would like to have.
Greece has blocked Macedonia's efforts to join NATO and the European Union because of the name, but Dimitrov has been telling his Greek counterparts that such moves only make things worse.
When you block your neighbor for too long, the public opinion in the neighborhood is not necessarily more constructive, but rather more defensive. And I have asked them to rethink that unblocking our road to NATO could actually be conducive to a more friendly political climate.
Dimitrov says people and businesses in both countries seem a lot less hung up about the name.
We have a tremendous exchange of citizens in terms of tourism over the border. Businesses are really cooperating. Greece is a very important trading partner. So this is a good basis to have a very friendly and open political relationship as well. And I'm sure that sometime in the future, we're going to be able to be very, very close allies.
So will it soon be the country formerly known as the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia? We promise to keep you posted. I'm Carol Hills. President Donald Trump breaks with tradition and decides not to host a traditional dinner marking the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Some American Muslims say the message to them is clear.
You are not welcome, and your religious traditions are not American enough.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. President Trump got a legal victory for his revised travel ban today. The Supreme Court partially lifted a lower court injunction on the ban on travelers from six majority Muslim nations. That means some of the ban can now go into effect, and the court will take up the full case in its next term. Meanwhile, here's another story about immigration and the courts. Ever since Trump took office, immigration advocates claim that immigration agents are showing up more often at courts to detain people. Alarm bells went off recently when agents went to a special court in New York City where defendants are supposed to be treated as victims, not criminals. Beth Fertig of Station WNYC was there.
The defendants in New York's human trafficking intervention courts have been arrested for prostitution-related offenses. They're seen as vulnerable people, often exploited by traffickers. Usually, their charges are dropped if they agree to meet with advocates who can help them with their problems. But earlier this month, something really unusual happened in the trafficking court in Queens. Yvonne Chen of the group Sanctuary for Families was there.
I saw an East Asian woman figuring out that ICE is there for her and terrified.
That's right. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. I was there, too, and they had apparently come for a petite, young Chinese woman with long hair wearing a sweatshirt. She was charged with offering to give an illegal type of massage and not having a license.
There were three deportation officers circling the courtroom.
Kate Mogulescu is supervising attorney at the Legal Aid Society. I saw her in the hallway as she approached one of the immigration agents, a young man wearing a black baseball cap just outside the courtroom doors. Nothing identified him as law enforcement. Mogulescu questioned him, and he showed her his badge under his T-shirt. Lee Latimer, also with Legal Aid, was there too. She says the judge told the young woman's lawyer that ICE was there for her.
In that moment, she asked the judge to set bail so that the client would be held in custody and give us time to find out what was happening and then talk to the client about what her options were.
The woman was handcuffed and met her lawyer in another room. As word spread that ICE was in the building, lawyers and their clients huddled in the hallway looking nervous. Then, around noon, the agent left. ICE acknowledged its officers arrested three people outside the courthouse that day. Mogulescu, with Legal Aid, has a theory.
I believe they came to court today with a list, a long list of people that they could take into custody. And I guess when they filled the van or whatever vehicle they came to court with today, they left.
ICE wouldn't comment on who it was looking for that day. I wasn't allowed to record in court, so I turned on my mic as the lawyer and her client, the young woman from China, left.
Yeah. But if you have any questions or if you want to talk about it, just let me know, okay?
Attorney Catherine Carbonaro walked the woman to her office. The client looked terrified. She did not want to be interviewed. After they talked, the client left in a taxi. Carbonaro was emotional.
This is probably going to happen to other clients, and that's terrifying to us.
Why?
Because these are really vulnerable clients, and now they might get deported. It's just like a horrible thing to think about.
New York State's chief judge also says she's greatly concerned and that courts should be treated like schools, hospitals, and other areas traditionally off limits to ICE. Immigration agents have been spotted in courts before, but not human trafficking court. ICE says courthouses are public buildings and that it needs to find people in court when police and jails don't turn them over, a common policy in so-called sanctuary cities like New York. But Judy Harris Kluger doesn't buy that argument. She's a former judge at a human trafficking court in New York. She now leads the nonprofit Sanctuary for Families, which advocates for victims of sex trafficking and domestic violence. She worries clients will fear going to court if immigration agents are present.
Courts should really be a safe place for people to go, whether they are defendants or victims. And certainly our clients are victims. They are putting themselves in danger by not going and getting the protections that they're entitled to.
If these people don't feel safe going to court and don't show up, immigrant advocates say they could face arrest, and those who are considered victims will be criminalized even more. For The World, Beth Fertig, New York City.
Most Muslims in the U.S. celebrated the end of the Muslim Ramadan holiday over the weekend, and for the past 20 years, there's been a dinner at the White House to mark the occasion. But Donald Trump has abandoned that tradition. Wajahat Ali is an American Muslim essayist and humorist who's been highly critical of Trump's rhetoric on Muslims. Wajahat, what does this gesture say to you?
It shows his endearing loyalty and love towards Muslims and Islam in America. I mean, it's been a love fest for the past year and a half. But in all seriousness, what it seems is yet another gesture towards a part of his base, which is seeking white nationalism, white supremacy at the cost of dignity, civil liberties of millions of their fellow Americans who happen to be a different color, different ethnicity, if they have ovaries or if they're Muslim. And it does nothing to advance religious liberties and freedoms, which are the bedrock of this country and very Jeffersonian. And the last thing I'll say is, and I got a lot of heat for this on Twitter from some of his base, I said this was a very un-American and un-Jeffersonian gesture by Donald Trump. And his base has said, no, of course not. Jefferson hated Islam and hated religions. They never did anything like this before, except Jefferson did in 1805. When he hosted the Tunisian ambassador, and very specifically to accommodate the Muslim Tunisian ambassador, on the letter, he told everyone that we will be opening our feast at sunset, which was during Ramadan, which was, believe it or not, guys, an iftar dinner all the way back in 1805.
How important is this White House tradition to Muslim Americans? I mean, is the media overreacting?
The media is not overreacting. It's the messenger. It's the administration, it's the Trump administration that goes out of its way to break a tradition which, A, celebrates our religious freedoms, B, shows us as a country that, hey, we welcome all faith traditions and we are acknowledging and respecting one of the major, if not the major, religious holiday of 1.6 billion people around the world. And the fact that Donald Trump and his administration and Rex Tillerson go out of their way not to celebrate it, breaking tradition of both Republican administrations, because George W. Bush did it, and also Clinton and Obama, signals to the rest of the world, and especially to 3 to 4 million American Muslims, you are not welcome, and your religious traditions are not American enough.
What if he had gone ahead and held the event? Wouldn't that have been awkward and looked just as disingenuous?
It would have. And there would have been, I think, a lot of walkouts. I don't think a lot of people would have attended. But this is not about the iftar itself. It's about the conversation he is having about Islam and Muslims in America.
You mentioned your Twitter account, and I was checking it out, and you take an interesting line, which is responding with humor, which is good for humorists. For example, one woman tweets, "This is America. Glad we're not wasting the taxpayers' money," you know, about Trump not having the iftar. And you write back to her, "Phew, glad we're only wasting it to pay for Trump's golf trips and for security at Trump Towers in New York City."
So she did not respond.
How did you decide to take this approach on Twitter?
So basically what happened is I had no idea that this tweet would go viral. You know, I'm celebrating Eid with my family. We're doing really Muslim-y exotic things like eating crab cake buffet after Eid prayer. And then at night, once I have a little bit of time, I see that this tweet goes viral and there's like just hundreds of these types of toxic, nasty responses. And so I prefer the Bugs Bunny approach, not the Daffy Duck approach. You could sit there, get angry, lose your mind, tear your hair out, but the anvil always drops on Daffy Duck's head. Or you could be like Bugs Bunny, have some fun with it. So I sat down for about 20 minutes and responded to about 20 of them. And for Muslims, the one thing we get the most is, "Go back to your country." And someone said, "Go back and slither back to where you came from." And I said, "My mother's womb from Los Altos Hospital in Berea, California? Okay, I'll try to do that." And then there was no response. And so I think having some dark humor about this stuff is cathartic. Because if you don't have some dark humor as a person of color or even as an American living in Trump's administration, you'll be depressed and angry and probably need Xanax every day. So I go for the humor approach. It's fun.
Wajah Ali is a Muslim American playwright, essayist, and humorist. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
2 years ago, a woman named Renee Rabinowitz was boarding a flight from the U.S. to Tel Aviv when she was asked to change her seat. The reason? The man sitting next to her was an ultra-Orthodox Jew, and he said he felt uncomfortable sitting next to a woman. Rabinowitz agreed to move, but felt she'd been wronged. So later, she decided to sue El Al, Israel's national airline. Last week, a court ruled in her favor, and her case has gotten a lot of attention in Israel. Isabel Kirshner has been following the story for the New York Times in Jerusalem.
Renee is in her 80s, very elegant, sharp-witted, retired lawyer. She now lives in an assisted living facility. And she was just going about her business, being a retired elderly woman when she got on that flight.
And what actually happened to her on that LL flight?
Well, she was traveling from Newark to Tel Aviv. She'd been visiting family. She sat down in her aisle seat in business class. And then the gentleman arrived who was assigned the seat next to her, the window seat. And clearly he was having a problem with that. She then was asked by the flight attendant, "Would you like me to move you to a better seat closer to first class?" Renee is, as I said, at the time she was 81. She has problems with her knees, walks with a cane, didn't really feel like moving, but kind of felt pressured into it. And she understood immediately why she was being asked to move, because the gentleman in question was a ultra-Orthodox Jewish man and obviously seemed uncomfortable about the prospect of sitting next to her for the flight. She did eventually move.
And at what point after that incident did she decide to sue the airline?
Well, it was quite a while after. What happened was she said she felt minimized and kind of humiliated and degraded. Why should somebody ask me to move just because I'm a woman? And it was actually a couple of months later when she went to a lecture at a Jewish study center in Jerusalem. And the woman giving the lecture, Annette Hoffman, happens to be the director of an action, an advocacy group, the Israel Religious Action Center. And they have been campaigning for several years in Israel against gender segregation in public spaces in Israel. They've won cases in the Supreme Court against the bus companies and the transport ministries about bus lines going through ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods where women were kind of expected to sit in the back of the bus. And they have now taken on the whole airline seat switching issue. Renee happened to be sitting in a lecture, and that happened to be talking about this issue of women being asked to move. And Renee put up her hand and said, "That happened to me." And when Annette heard about this, she said, "Well, we've been looking for a case, for a test case of somebody who was actually asked or felt pressured to move, having been asked by a flight attendant. Would you want to go to court? And if so, we would represent you." And that is how it happened.
So what was her case based on? She sues the airline, and what did she allege?
Well, she was claiming that discrimination, she was asked to move because of her gender, and that this is unacceptable discrimination.
Based in Israel's own laws.
Absolutely. Israel's laws and consumer laws and public space codes do not allow discrimination based on gender.
How come in the Rene Rabinowitz case and others, how come the Orthodox man doesn't change his seat?
Well, I think in cases where there is an available seat next to another man, then the ultra-Orthodox male passenger objecting to the seat assigned would happily move and sit next to another man. In this particular case, and this happens on flights, there isn't another available seat next to a man.
How does Rene Rabinowitz feel today about winning the case?
Well, she told me she was exhilarated. It all happened rather quickly. It was a hearing that she was attending. She was in the court, and she wasn't actually expecting there to be a verdict that day. So she was quite thrilled.
What does her win mean? I mean, what's the takeaway from all this?
Well, the takeaway is that, you know, it's another step on the way to enforcing the anti-discrimination laws here, certainly in this very fraught battlefield between religion and gender and public space. And, you know, I think it's a step on the way to formalizing that there cannot be gender segregation in these public spheres. And I think from that perspective, it's quite a broad victory.
Isabel Kirshner is the Jerusalem correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks so much, Isabel.
Thank you very much.
Before we take a break, here's a preview of an interview you'll hear tomorrow. It's with the author Kevin Kwan. He lives in New York, but his novels poke fun at the rich and famous of Singapore and Hong Kong.
One of the things that I do in my book is I really delineate the different types of money, because there has existed for centuries now an old money culture in Singapore that's very similar to, you know, sort of the WASP or the British aristocracy, where it's very discreet. No one is showing off their money. You know, everyone's living in old houses, driving old cars, living extremely privileged, rarefied lives, but it's all very, very under the radar. And these old fortunes are clashing against so much of the new money that's been made over the past 20 years in Singapore, in Southeast Asia. And then, of course, there's been the advent of the very, very new instant money coming from mainland China, what I call the China rich. So it's really about how all these different classes of money clash with one another.
Novelist Kevin Kwan joins us right here tomorrow. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is in Washington visiting President Donald Trump today. It's their first official meeting, but Trump has already called Modi a true friend on Twitter, and they share at least some of the same political philosophy. Modi's slogan, "Make in India," mirrors Trump's America First approach. Chidanand Rajagopta is the Washington correspondent for The Times of India. He says the similarities don't end there.
Their political rise was quite unexpected and exceptional. They both swam against the established norms and the establishment itself in one case, and came out unexpected victors. They have strong personalities. They're, what shall I say, not exactly alpha male, but they're very striking in their in the way they present themselves.
One similarity they seem to have is their fondness for Twitter.
Indeed, yeah. They're both, what shall we call, social media beings. Officials on both sides have pointed out that they are two of the, what shall we say, the world's leaders with the largest following. Mr. Trump, I just checked yesterday and found Mr. Trump has something like 32 million followers on Twitter. Mr. Modi is not far behind, 30.5 or thereabouts. And they both tweet quite a bit, although the nature of their tweets are a little different. Mr. Trump's tweets are fairly political. They're also controversial. He likes to refer to television shows, news shows, and sometimes they're personal. Mr. Modi's feeds are fairly staid by comparison.
When Modi first visited the U.S. as prime minister in 2014, he had a massive rally in Madison Square Garden. This visit seems to be a little bit quieter. How come?
Yeah, I get a sense that the Indian side is keeping it low-key. My sense is they could have gone in for a bigger show, but obviously they didn't want to make a big sort of to-do about it. And Mr. Trump is fond of his own rallies and likes to boast of the big rallies he hosts. I don't think he'd like any, anybody else stealing the thunder. And besides, this is also their first meeting. And we were told repeatedly that this is more by way of them getting to know each other. So my sense is that the Indians like to keep it low-key.
What are the biggest issues right now between the U.S. and India?
If you're talking of issues where there is some potential for disagreement and conflict, it would be the economy, business, trade particularly. India's biggest strength is its manpower. And when we talk of trade in goods and services, India may not have the goods, but it has the services, and services by way of exporting its skilled manpower. And the U.S. increasingly has erected barriers against it.
You're talking about the H-1B visas.
H-1B, and pretty much there are a couple of guest worker visas, H-1B, there's something else called L-1, which involves intercompany transfers. So there are a bunch of guest worker visas, and all of them have been subjected to tariffs in the sense that the processing fee for the visas have been hiked to a great degree, $4,000, $5,000 in some cases. They're also slowing down the processes, and India sees that as a barrier. The U.S. sees the Indian economy as still being closed despite all the reforms and all the changes. They like to complain that there are high tariffs. So both sides have issues, and that is probably the most significant difference between the two sides.
What do you think people in India really want to come out of this visit?
I think they'd like to see a continuation of, we have to roll back a little bit. U.S.-India relations have progressed and improved dramatically over the last 20 years. It's been gradual. It's been significant. We thought it had peaked with the Bush years, but Obama carried it even further. And so they'd like to see a continuity. At least they wouldn't like to see a disruption in this very close relationship, which has gotten better over the last 20 years.
Chidanand Rajagata is the Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Times of India. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's finish up this Monday with a look back at one of the most influential musicians of the 20th century. October will mark the 100th birthday of jazz pianist and composer Thelonious Monk. And now, 35 years after his death, there's a new album out that features some of his previously unreleased music. It's the full soundtrack to the 1960 French film Dangerous Liaisons. Monk's biographer, Robin Kelly, says it was recorded at a key moment in Monk's life.
The recordings themselves really represented Monk sort of at the height of his powers on the one hand, but also in the aftermath of a serious mental breakdown. You know, 1959 was an odd time for Monk because on the one hand, he was recognized as one of the really outstanding jazz pianists and composers. And at the same time, the mental illness had become worse. He only months before had been diagnosed as what they call manic depression, or manic depressive. So by the time he went to the studio to make this recording, he had just begun taking medication. So he was sort of in limbo in a sense, famous but still struggling to make ends meet. But nevertheless, he went into the studio, recorded the soundtrack, and played some extraordinary music. Panonica was a song that he had written for his friend Panonica de Condeswater, whose home he was spending a lot of time in, and where he actually saw the film. It's a ballad, kind of mid-tempo, beautiful song. And it was used throughout the soundtrack in certain romantic moments. It is significant that the soundtrack is coming out in Monk's centennial year. October 10th, he turns 100, and Monk is making a comeback. You know, I think that his music, and this is a cliche, but it's true, his music is timeless. It's something that's always ahead of its time. It's very, very both dissonant, but also deep in the level of musicality and melody. You could hear Monk everywhere. And I think there's a lot of interest in what Monk has to offer in terms of not just acoustic jazz, but in terms of breaking with central rules of harmony, you know. He has always been avant-garde. He will continue to be avant-garde. And he will continue to be the pianist that most young piano players will either study or find frustrating because his music is very difficult, and always find new ways to create their own sound.
Robin Kelly is Thelonious Monk's biographer. We heard newly released recordings of classic Monk tunes from 1960. And no, it just never gets old. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.